everybody. How are you doing today? This is Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food on June 10th, 2014. I am so excited. Can you hear the excitement in my voice? I'm excited, and I'm exhausted. So today is June 10th, and later on today, we will be premiering our new documentary, The Lone Vegan Preaching to the Fire. It's not up yet, but what is up yet is our trailer. So if you visit responsibleeatingandliving.com, you can watch the quick little trailer, and then later on this evening, and it'll be available for quite some time, you can watch the, it's about 70 minutes, our documentary of my trip to talking to 250 cattle producers about climate change, and just listening to the program before this one, of course we need sustainable solutions to our energy problem, which is creating all kinds of havoc on the climate. But we also need to be eating plants because that has a tremendous impact on the environment. But that's not what I want to talk about today, or maybe I will, maybe later. But I want to introduce my guest, Dr. Antoinette Roba, and he's a physician in private practice in Fairfax, Virginia. Dr. Roba is president and co-founder of International Fund for Africa, a Houston-based 501c3 not-for-profit organization and registered international non-governmental organization in Ethiopia, dedicated to helping both human and non-human animals in Africa. Welcome to It's All About Food, Dr. Roba.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining me. I'm so glad that we were finally able to connect and hit on this very important day. It's your birthday.
Yes, it is.
Can I sing happy birthday to you?
You don't have to, but if you'd like to, sure.
I do. Everybody, join in with me. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Dr. Roba. Happy birthday to That's my special
like
happy birthday song to you.
Oh, thank you. I feel like I'm in the opera or something.
That's right.
High notes there.
A few little high notes for you.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to be celebrating your birthday, and I'm very glad that you're alive.
Thank you. So am I.
Yeah. Good. That's good to hear. Now, you're a vegan doctor, are you not?
Yes, I am.
Yes, and just briefly, when did you become vegan and why?
Around 2001, 2002 is when I became vegan. The why can be, the explanation might be a little long, but the short version of it is I got a dog, a little Maltese, who became my soulmate. And one day I was walking him, holding him in my hands, and I felt his little heartbeat. Mm. And it just hit me. Here I am. I love this little guy to death. I would do anything for him. And you know, when I felt his heartbeat, I said, you know, I don't know how, I don't know why, but I just made that connection between a chicken or, you know, another animal that we eat without hesitating. And they have a heartbeat. They feel, they're just like my little dog. I didn't see any difference. I couldn't figure out what the difference was that, you know, caused me to love one and eat the other.
Well, I'm glad you made that connection. And what surprises me is why more doctors and more people don't.
Yeah, and that's really, he started me on a journey that ended up, you know, me being vegan. And not only that, but even starting this organization that I lead in Africa, which is basically an organization that works for both animals and human beings and promotes veganism in Africa.
Well, I always like to say this, that when I talk about being vegan, many people respond with, you care so much about the animals, what about the people? And I believe that most of us who care about animals also care about humans, and we realize the connection, and here you have an organization that helps both.
Yes. And you can, if people think that, you know, we only care about animals, they don't get it.
They don't get it.
Yeah.
All right. Let's just talk first about being a doctor. So you work in the emergency room?
I used to. I practice. I work certified in emergency medicine. I practice for close to 20 years, and actually a little more than 20 years. And then I decided I was done with the adrenaline rush. I was getting a little older, and I couldn't get as excited as I used to about seeing people's chest open after a gunshot wound. Mm. So I decided to go into functional medicine, anti-aging, which is a lot more, interesting to me. It's more about prevention and figuring out and understanding, the pathology of disease and why things happen on a cellular basis. So it really fascinated me, and I got into that, and I opened my clinic in Fairfax, Virginia. I've been open for a couple of months now.
Oh, great. So I'm assuming you're talking to your patients about plant-based diets, and how are they responding?
A lot of the people that I talk to are not, obviously, they're not vegan, and a lot of them get in trouble, medically because of their habits, which are very hard to change. So, I have my challenges, and I've gotten my work cut out for me. But it's going to be a lot of work and a lot of effort, but I think eventually I think I will prevail to convince people to go in the way of a plant-based diet.
Most people don't even get that far with a first step with a doctor that they respect telling them that they could do dramatic positive things with their health by just changing the way they eat.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree.
And occasionally I'll go and see a doctor, and it's always a frustrating experience because I always end up lecturing them about what they know, what they should be telling me about nutrition that they're not doing. And unfortunately, a lot of them have told me they just don't think people want to hear that information.
It's not that. Not only that, unfortunately, I hate to admit this, but medical schools don't teach nutrition. Doctors have very little knowledge about nutrition. If a doctor doesn't take time to teach him or herself, when you leave medical school and then go into practice, you really don't know much about nutrition. So part of it is ignorance, and part of it is, the stress of, getting patients in and out quickly doesn't leave time for them to sit down and talk to them about their medical conditions. Actually, that's one of the reasons why I decided to leave emergency medicine, because I was seeing so many patients that had doctors, and they were dying right in front of me. They were coming every week for the same problem, and it's getting worse because the main issue wasn't being addressed. And the main issue wasn't being addressed because, A, the doctor just pushes medications on them. And really, they may care. It's not that I don't think doctors don't care. It's just they don't have the time to sit down and learn about people's, lifestyles, and learn about, their issues and, their diet and their stress levels and their, other, familial problems that they have. And the other thing is, they just don't, they don't have the time, and they don't have the knowledge base when it comes to nutrition, like I said before. So I was seeing patients that, were obese, 500-600 pounds, young people in their 20s, 30s with diabetes, high blood pressure, some of them who've had strokes, and they're not even on blood pressure medications, or they've not been told. When I ask them, has your doctor talked to you about diet? They'll tell me. Some of them might be lying, but a lot of them are truthful when they say, no, nobody told me that if I do this and that, I can change things, So it became very frustrating to me to practice in an environment that I was seeing, it's a revolving door of people who are slowly going down the drain, and you know, and their disease processes can be prevented, and absolutely preventable diseases that people are dying of because of lack of knowledge and ignorance on the part of the patient and the physician. And so I said, you know, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to go out and practice medicine the way it should be. You know, one, take time to sit down and talk to patients, learn about their situation, and try to address their problems at the core, and sit down and explain to them how they, by modifying their lifestyle, they can prevent a lot of diseases that once the disease processes start, it's just a downhill trajectory.
Well, thank you for doing what you're doing, and we definitely need more doctors like you, and our system, it's changing, but it needs to change even more so. And it's the medical system needs to change, but also each one of us is individuals. Hello, listeners. I know you're included in this group. We need to take responsibility for our own health and not rely on entirely on the medical profession, because when we learn about health, and fortunately with the internet, a lot of that knowledge is available for free, and if we listen to our bodies, we can find health, and it starts with nutritious plant foods. Okay, let's move to Ethiopia and the International Fund for Africa.
Yeah.
So you were born in Ethiopia?
Yes, I was born in Ethiopia, but grew up mostly in the U.S. I go back and forth, and a couple of years ago, I decided that I wanted to give back to my to the country of my birth and where my roots are.
Mm-hmm.
And we established the International Fund for Africa, and like I said, you know, even though I would be lying if I told you my heart is with animals, I feel very connected, but I also feel very strongly that I should contribute as a physician to the health of people in my country. And there's, you know, a lot of suffering, and especially in the rural parts of Africa, in Ethiopia. And so, you know, we started working and trying to improve the healthcare in rural parts of Ethiopia. And we've been doing it for the last 6-7 years, but we also work on issues related to dogs and then also trying to promote veganism.
Now, you were probably young when you left Ethiopia, but has it changed a lot since you were born there and since you've been back?
Changed in what sense?
Well, in terms of the economic stability, what people are eating, their health, their knowledge, the food that they eat.
Okay. Yes, there's been a lot of change. Economically, the country has grown. It's improved in a lot of ways. Unfortunately, the environment with civilization, with improvement and growth comes all the complications of toxic environment, toxic water, the air being polluted. So, you know, there are a lot of problems with, chronic diseases that are showing up, which was not an issue when I was growing up as much. But the other thing that's changed dramatically is the rate of chronic diseases related to nutritional deficiencies, especially diabetes, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease. Ethiopian and cancer, by the way, and people are, you know, especially in the urban areas, not so much in the rural areas, people are eating more and more of the Western diet, which, you know, I don't have to tell you what that contains. And because of that, there's a dramatic increase in diabetes and high blood pressure and the rate of cancer. So in that sense, things have gone, badly. And the government, and not only Ethiopia for that matter, but all the rest of Africa are, you know, really, the governments are worried because, you know, the last thing they need is dealing with chronic, you know, the economic impact of
it's
dealing
expensive.
With chronic Yeah. I mean, the U.S., as rich as the United States is having a hard time dealing with chronic diseases. Now, imagine that being, you know, happening in Africa. I mean, infectious diseases were the, you know, the problems that African countries were facing a couple of decades ago. And now the economic impact is, you know, dealing with diabetes and its complications, hypertension and its complications, stroke and its complications, cancer and its complications. And it's becoming, you know, it's going to break the back of the healthcare system in any African country because they're, you know, they don't have enough reserves to handle that kind of financial stress.
So the images that I have in my memory of Ethiopia are from the droughts and the starvation. And does that still exist?
You know, I can't say for sure if you know there aren't pockets of areas where people are starving. I would be giving false information if I said it didn't. But I know this much: whatever conditions existed many years ago, and you know the big famine of 1984 and a few others since then, are not being replicated anymore as much as they used to. But are there some areas of famine and periods of drought that cause people to die? Probably, yes.
So I think some people might attribute this, I don't want to say improvement, but from going from malnourishment to having diseases of abundance, I guess, is because they've been growing more animals for food.
Yes, absolutely. But it's also an issue of distribution. It's also an issue of urban versus rural. A lot of the disease of, you know, associated with abundance happen to be in urban areas and happens to be happening to people that are financially well off. Starvation or hunger or malnutrition because of lack of food mostly happens in rural areas to people that are very poor. So it's an issue of politics involved in economics and social justice issues that come into play. But also, you know, there a lot of companies are moving in from North America, Europe, and even the Middle East, who are setting up factory farms, and they're producing a lot of meat for, you know, import for export, and that basically involves the production, rearing a lot of animals, and you know, increasing their numbers tenfold. So that's become a phenomenon that's affecting Africa. You know, especially in countries like Ethiopia, South Africa, Kenya, I think Ghana, and a few other places, mostly in Botswana, for example, where they're beginning to be exporters of meat and hide and stuff like that, and that creates its own problems, not only, you know, with nutrition, but inequalities, social inequalities, and also major impact on the environment, basically. Climate change, which is becoming an issue in Africa. It is an issue already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have a lot of animals grazing, there's desertification, arable lands disappear, and, you know, that leads to basically big areas, chunks of land becoming useless. They can't be used anymore. The point I'm trying to make is it's multifactorial issues that are causing all these upheavals and changes.
Now, I have not been to Ethiopia, but I have been to Ethiopian restaurants. And I love the food, and everyone that I've ever been to all around this country, the United States, always has wonderful vegetarian options. And I love the teff bread injera, how is it pronounced?
Injera.
Injera. and all the wonderful different dishes with beans and grains and the lovely spices. Are people eating the same food, or is the food just adding more meat to these basic dishes?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's not that the food has changed. It's still injera, but on top of the injera, you have, you know, raw meat, you have chicken, you have eggs, you have, you know, everything. All, you know, fish, you name it. They use a lot of butter, you know, and so it's not that the injera has changed, and not that the vegetarian food isn't there. It's just, you know, if they're not fasting, nobody's eating vegetarian food, period.
Mm.
Unless you're a vegetarian like me. So if you go to an Ethiopian restaurant, you know, as you may know, the Ethiopian the Greek Orthodox religious sect, of which most Ethiopians belong to, they fast like 200 something days out of the year.
Whoa.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so during that time, of course, fish is allowed, but other than that, they eat vegetarian food. But if it's not a fasting day, which is usually Wednesdays and Fridays, and then maybe a period of a couple of weeks before Easter and sometime in December, they eat meat, you know, so it's nobody during that time. No, you can't go to a restaurant and see anybody eating vegetarian food. So the only association they have with vegetarian food is when it comes, you know, when they think of, you know, fasting and religious reasons.
Okay, so you have your organization, and you what exactly are you doing in Africa with the International Fund for Africa?
Well, we're doing many things in different situations. Right now, we're involved in a feeding program for children whose parents have died of AIDS. Mm-hmm. These kids are anywhere from 5 to 15 years old. They go to school and they eat once a day, sometimes less than once a day.
Mm.
And we've created a relationship with the school to provide vegan foods to these kids who now eat three times a day.
Wow.
And we're also creating a little garden where they can grow their own, I mean, the school can grow the vegetarian food and then provide that food to these kids. So That's our recent efforts, and we're actually growing that into, you know, extending it to a couple of different schools, because a lot of these schools, it's unbelievably sad to see kids who come to school and they have no parents, they've died, and they're either staying on the street or some family member is keeping them, just barely letting them live with them. But they come to school and they're separated from those kids that have parents who come with food and they eat, while these young little kids who don't have families don't eat anything. I've seen it with my own eyes, and it just breaks your heart to see this. How can you have two kids, you know, one eating and the other one sitting there watching another kid eat? So anyway, we decided to do that, so that's one of the things we're doing. In the past, what we've done is we've gone on medical missions to rural Ethiopia and taken doctors from the U.S. and from Ethiopia and treated people in very difficult situations in rural Ethiopia. In 2012, we went and treated about 5,000 people, restored the eyesight of about 300 people. And, you know, previous years we've had other missions where we do the same thing. That's one of the things that we do. We're also trying to get involved in rural development to help people with water projects and, you know, other things that help improve their lives. We're also, like I said earlier, we support organizations in some parts of Africa that are promoting veganism are vegetarian societies, and they need a little help with money. We try to provide money when we have it. And we also work with the government to help decrease the suffering and torture of homeless dogs and equines who have very difficult lives in Ethiopia. We've partnered with the HSUS and Best Friends Animal Societies in the past to work to help homeless animals, you know, provide them with rabies injections and find them homes. And, you know, those are the main things that we've been doing, and we're continuing to do as much as we can. But unfortunately, funding is always an issue, and, you know, it kind of limits us from doing a lot more than what we're doing already.
Yeah, that's a frustrating thing. There's a lot of money out there, but it's not going to where it's needed.
Yep.
So I wish that you get as much funding as you possibly can manage.
Yep.
And right. Now you're in Virginia, and it's the United States, but there's still economic issues here in the United States with people and not getting the nutrition they need, even though we consider ourselves a very wealthy nation. Do you see that in your practice?
At this point, I'm not focusing on that because I'm just starting out. I have to see how things go. And, you know, to be honest with you, my focus is, a lot to, you know, in Africa, and that's hard enough getting funding to do as much as we're doing and to be able to do much more. But obviously, you know, I am open to helping people in the United States and animals. In my time off and when I have a little time, I rescue dogs in Houston, and now I'll probably get involved in Virginia. I rescue and foster dogs, but am I open to helping human beings? Hell yes.
Well, you're a vegan, so you have tons of energy, and you can just do a lot.
Yeah, and I hope so. I want to stay healthy and do as much as I can, because I only have one chance on this trip called life.
Yeah. Now, you've contributed a chapter to the book Circle of Compassion. When is that being released? Do you know?
July.
Oh, so it's next month coming out. And what was your chapter about?
It's a very controversial chapter. In 2009, I went to Ghana, and I went to the Gold Coast of Ghana where the slave trade basically started. And, you know, I went to see the castle from which slaves were transported to the Americas, and it had a huge impact on me. And basically my chapter is about my impression of, you know, making comparisons between animal slavery and human slavery and the connection.
Well, I'm glad you've done that. I know that it is controversial, and there are big connections. And I'm always saying we treat animals horribly, but we treat humans horribly too.
Yes,
all connected.
We definitely do.
Yep. And we like to think that there is no slavery, at least in the United States, and we are continually hearing horrific stories about how slavery still exists, and in this country and in other countries, or if people aren't quite slaves, they're near slaves and have very little flexibility and freedom.
Yeah, there are more slaves now than there were any time in the past, by the way. And across the globe. So slavery is, you know,
is alive and well.
Just fine.
Yeah, alive
and well. And then we have animal slavery that's going on everywhere. So it's not only humans, you know. As far as I'm concerned, every factory farm anywhere in the United States is a dungeon of where these slaves are put in. That's the way I see it.
Amen to that. Well, Dr. Roba, It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I'm just delighted to hear about the wonderful work that you're doing here and in Africa. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay. I look forward to reading the Circle of Compassion, especially your controversial chapter.
Yeah, please, and let me know what you think once you read it.
Okay, I will. And people can find you. What's your website?
www.ifundafrica.org.
Very good. Okay, thank you. Have a wonderful birthday.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye. That was Dr. Anthony Roba, and it was his birthday, and I'm glad. All right, let's take a break and be back in a few minutes. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is It's All About Food. Hey, everybody. I'm back. It's time for It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's June 10th, 2014. Get it right. June 10th. But the reason why I said June 14th is because I wanted to talk about some events that are going on, and there's one on June 14th, 2014. And I just heard about this recently, and I was really happy to hear about it and surprised about it. So the French are at it again. They've come up with a march called the March for Closing Down of All the Slaughterhouses, Fermons les Abattoirs. They have a website, fermonslesabattoirs.org. Actually, it's fermons-les-abattoirs.org. And they have a march. And it's taking place in Paris, London, Sydney, Toronto, Los Angeles, Montreal, and New York, Bern, and Toulouse. It was last week in Bern and Toulouse, and this June 14th in Paris, London, Sydney, Toronto, Los Angeles, Montreal, and New York. So if you're in any of these big cities, maybe you'll check that out and participate in the closing of all slaughterhouses. Interesting title, interesting approach, and it makes me think about the Veggie Pride Parade, which I've participated in numerous years here in New York and also in Paris, because it started in Paris. And that's what makes me smile, because both of these protest marches have started in Paris. And as I've mentioned before, I lived in France, south of France, actually, for 4 years in the early 90s. And, of course, France is the culinary country of the world, right? We think of all the great food and culinary skills come from France. I never met another vegetarian when I lived there. And now these big marches and protests about killing animals are all coming out of Paris. And I wish I had met those people when I had lived there. But maybe they didn't live there. Maybe they hadn't been born yet or they weren't old enough yet. But now they're doing some great work. So I would check that out if you can and participate, because we need to be heard. And it's, as they say on their website, it's time to claim loud and clear the abolition of slavery of all the animals. The abolition of the practices which caused them the biggest wrongs, their breeding, their fishing, and their slaughter. And we were just talking about slavery, so this is right in line with that. And, okay, that's kind of the dark side of things. I wanted to talk about the happy light side of things, so I went to the Veggie Prom this past weekend, and what a wonderful thing that was. So there's a website, veggieprom.org, and Jessica Mahady is the organizer of this event, and what a fun thing. It's a great party where you know you can eat all the food because everything is vegan, and they had some wonderful little cupcakes and chocolate treats and dips, schmears, and little veggie things and crackers, and it was a great time to just be normal, have a nice night out, and listen to great music and dance, and know that you were among people who felt the way you did, and you didn't even have to talk about it. It was just a given. It was just a moment of how the world could be, where we could have our cake and eat it too, where we could go out and listen to music and enjoy great food and know that there was no cruelty involved in getting there. wow, that was really a fun event. So check them out. I think there's one in Los Angeles as well. And if you want to start your own wherever you are, check out veggieprom.com and do your own. Very, very fun. And you don't need a date. You can just come as you are. So those are a couple of big events going on. And then I wanted to talk about what some of the things that are going on in the news. So just today, the FDA put out a press announcement, a news release for immediate release about fish consumption. They've updated their advice for fish consumption. And basically, the FDA and the EPA have made recommendations about the maximum amount of fish that people should eat, specifically pregnant women and young children. And the concern has always been that these groups should not eat too much fish because they can get mercury poisoning or get too much mercury, which will affect developmental health. And so now they have put out a minimum amount of fish that is appropriate for pregnant and breastfeeding women and young children. And I think it's something like 12 ounces a week is the minimum. Let's see here. The draft updated advice recommends pregnant women eat at least 8 ounces and up to 12 ounces, 2 to 3 servings per week, of a variety of fish that are lower in mercury to support fetal growth and development. All right. So what's really necessary here is DHA and EPA that we get from either fish or from algae. And this is what's important for developmental health and the intelligence in babies and young children. But the first thing that always surprised me about this kind of advice is if you're telling women and young children not to eat too much of this particular food, why would anybody want to eat this food if it has things in it that can affect your health? I don't eat fish, and it's for two reasons. One is I don't believe in killing sentient beings, and there are so many wonderful stories about fish and about their lives and their emotions and their families and their lifestyles that I don't want to kill them. But the other thing is I don't think it's healthy to eat fish, especially today with our polluted waters. And there may be some concern because people read this type of information and think that they need fish for certain nutrients. And specifically, there's a lot of conversation about omega-3 fatty acid supplements. And in the vegan vegetarian world, we eat flax seeds and hemp seeds, dark leafy green vegetables. A lot of us talk about the ratio between omega-6 fatty acids and omega-3 fatty acids. Many people are eating a lot of processed foods, which are high in omega-6 fatty acids, and so what happens is you need to eat more omega-3 fatty acids in order to have a decent ratio, which is healthy for you. And I think the first step is to eliminate the processed food so you don't get an abundance of omega-6 fatty acids. And then the question is your body capable of taking the omega-3 fatty acids that you're eating in the form of flax seeds or dark leafy green vegetables and hemp seeds or wherever you're getting them from, and making the DHA and EPA that the body needs, I'm going to attempt to pronounce these, the docosahexaenic and the eicosapentaenoic acids. And there have been some interesting studies that have come out, and there was one recently in Clinical Nutrition, published in March. And it was a small group of vegans that were recruited, actually, and their omega-3 was determined with some blood testing. And they were low in omega-3 levels, but not lower than omnivores who also consume very little of the DHA and EPA. And what the study found is when they supplemented with a vegetarian form of DHA, EPA, their levels went to a healthy level. So why I'm bringing this up is, why would we want to eat fish if it's filled with mercury, if it's filled with toxic chemicals from our polluted waters, and if it's loaded with cholesterol and has no fiber? But we need something from fish. But if we could get it from plant sources, or if we could get it where the fish get it from, isn't that better? The fish get their omega-3 fatty acids from algae, and that's where we can get it. And fortunately today, we can buy supplements of DHA. Now, some may say it's expensive, and it is kind of pricey. So what I think is the ideal thing is to once a year get a blood test to check for your levels to see that you have adequate amounts, just like people are testing now for vitamin D. That's the hot nutrient that everybody seems to need to supplement. And you can check to see where your vitamin D levels are, and vitamin D seems to be linked with every illness, every disease out there. We need vitamin D, and most of us are indoors all the time and at our jobs, in offices, and don't get out in the sun enough. And people are afraid of the sun for skin cancer. I personally think it's good to get a little bit of sun, maybe not in the peak hours, but I think we're meant to be out there, and it's good to get sun. But vitamin D supplementation is possible, and we can check our levels with blood tests. And we can check our levels of DHA with blood tests, too. But here's the trick, and I haven't figured this out entirely yet. In New York, in the lovely state of New York, we can only use labs that are approved by the state of New York. So if there's a lab that does a special test that you want done, but they're not approved by the state of New York, you can't have your blood drawn in New York and sent to that lab for evaluation. You have to leave New York. You can have your blood drawn in New Jersey or Connecticut and have it sent, and then the results can be sent to New Jersey or Connecticut. They can't be sent to you in New York. It's like unbelievable, but it's true. And there are some kits that you can order. I know Dr. Furman has one, but they cannot send it to you in New York because the work is done in a lab that is not approved by the New York Health Department. So my question is, and maybe someone out there can let me know at info@realmeals.org, are there labs in New York that are approved where you can have your blood drawn in New York and get DHA testing? That's what I want to know. And if anyone knows, I would appreciate that information. Because if you found that your levels were fine, then you wouldn't need to supplement, at least not right now. Studies have shown that as we age, it's harder for the body to take the omega-3 fatty acids and make the DHA and EPA that we need. And so supplementation might be required as we age. And a reason why it's important is because this is linked to things like dementia. And I would rather take the steps now to keep my brain healthy rather than regret it later, even though I may not be able to remember later if I had dementia. And the crazy thing is that there's information linked to dementia with eating fish because of mercury and the toxic chemicals. So you want to eat the fish in order to get the DHA and EPA in order to prevent dementia, but you're getting other things in the fish that are going to give you dementia. It doesn't make any sense. Am I making sense? So get your DHA from algae, please. Thank you very much. All of that from a little press release from the FDA today on fish consumption. Now, I get all kinds of emails. I'm on a variety of different lists. Not quite sure how I got on some of them, but I am. And I got an email from the Independent Women's Forum. Are you familiar with the Independent Women's Forum? And when I first got it, I thought, not this particular email, but a while ago when I first got an email from the Independent Women's Forum, and I went, oh, Independent Women's Forum. I'm an independent woman. I want to read what they have to say. And as I read whatever was in that particular message, I was confused because the information in their email really wasn't in sync with what I thought was important, and or the information wasn't anything that I would want to support. And so I looked them up and found out, of course, the Independent Women's Forum is a politically conservative American nonprofit organization, and they're focused on policy issues of concern to women, but not this woman. They are from a conservative standpoint, and they advocate equity feminism, there are equity feminists that are described as anti-feminists by their critics. And so I got an email from them recently, and I thought for fun I would read it now that I'm aware of who they are and what their agenda is about. And so they were talking about, the title of this email was, 2 dozen free market organizations voice concern and urge reform of the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee for political agendas versus sound nutrition. And they're organizing in order to get people to let Congress know that they are concerned about the approach to the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, a federally mandated committee of officials chosen by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And they revised the federal dietary guidelines. Ultimately, these are used in schools, for example. And I've never been particularly happy with these dietary guidelines. I think they've gotten a little better over the year, but you can remember the infamous four food groups, meat and dairy, grains and vegetables. Is that what the four groups were a long time ago? The guidelines are getting a little bit better. We had the MyPlate come out a year or two ago, and it's more vegetable focused, and that's good. But this particular email said that they wanted the committee to consider or adopt certain reforms. And the number one reform, I have to read this because it just blew my mind. Number one, mission focused. Ensure that the committee stays focused on health and nutrition issues and does not use the dietary guidelines process to advance personal ideology on issues such as the environment, animal rights, immigration, sustainability, and other non-dietary matters. That's a mouthful, isn't it? And not too easy to digest. The thing is, in my opinion, the environment is absolutely a dietary matter. Animal rights is a dietary matter, and sustainability is a dietary matter, and immigration is a dietary matter, because all of these are related to our food production. They are all connected, and we cannot consider our food production fairly if we're not considering environment, animal rights, immigration, sustainability. They are dietary matters. Unfortunately, many of our plants that are grown for food are harvested by immigrants, some of them legal, some of them illegal, some of them, many of them, not paid very well, not treated very well. So there is an issue there. How many times do we talk about animals on this show and animals for food and how they're not healthy for us to consume and how horribly they're treated? And sustainability. Can we keep dumping toxic pesticides and herbicides into the soil? Can we keep dumping petrochemical-based fertilizers, digging deep into the earth for fossil fuels and then using them and burning them and having them go into the atmosphere and warming our environment and creating global warming? Everything's connected. So I wrote to them. I didn't get an answer back. But something to keep an eye out for, people that have very clever-sounding names for their organizations, sounding like something you may want to participate in, and then you read deeply into what they're promoting, and you just may want to run in the opposite direction. That's the Independent Women's Forum. Right, so we just have a few minutes left. Can we talk about gardening? Because it is that time of year, and I just wanted to report on my little garden here at, in New York City on my terrace. So I started a few weeks ago. Of course, we had no spring, okay? So there was no time to plant seeds. I don't know what the farmers have been doing. And I give them so much credit for being able to provide us with fruits and vegetables, because when the weather is so crazy and when there's one frost after another, I don't know how they get plants started. So I've saved seeds over the year. I've saved them from plants that I've grown, and I've saved them from some foods that I've eaten. For example, I've had some heirloom tomatoes, and I would save the seeds from those tomatoes, and now I can grow heirloom tomato plants. And how fascinating, how fun is that? And you can buy heirloom tomato seeds, but they're not cheap. And how easy is it to save your own seeds? You know, nature intended for us to do this, save seeds and then grow plants for food. But who's doing that anymore? And people have forgotten to do it. I had some friends over recently, and one of them was asking me, you mean you can grow plants from seeds? You can grow food just by putting them in dirt and adding water to them? It's amazing how much knowledge most of us have lost. So I'm saving my seeds, and I just planted some, and I've got these wonderful plants growing. I'm not sure how they're going to make it, but I'm giving them a fair try. I've got some squash growing, and they take up a lot of room, so I'm going to have to find a little more real estate on my terrace for them. I've got peas growing, and as I mentioned before, I've got some yellow heirloom tomatoes and some red heirloom tomatoes and herbs, like the dill's coming up. I've got some other herbs that didn't come up, so I'm going to have to throw in some new seeds in the mix and try and bring them up. And it's a great thing. It's a great thing to do with kids. I've seen more kids coming home from school with little seedlings to plant, but that means the parents are going to have to take care of them and plant them in order for them to grow. But so important for all of us to know where our food comes from and not make any kinds of assumptions. I just have 2 minutes left, and just briefly, I want to mention again the Lone Vegan documentary, Preaching to the Fire. All you have to do is go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. Right now you can watch the trailer. The documentary will be up later this evening and will be available in subsequent days for you to view. It's about 70 minutes, and it's the story of the trip that I made to a feedlot in Nevada, and how I participated on a panel as the lone vegan and spoke to 250 cattle producers about climate change. It was really fun to make and exhausting, and I will be very happy to tie up this project later this evening and have you watch the documentary. Please let me know if you've watched it and what you think of it. And I guess that's all I'm going to say for this show, June 10th, 2014. Thank you for joining me, and have a delicious week.